Well, I think we're going to begin. Tuvia's question about the method that we're using is a great place as any to begin. Tuvia from Miami is asking, after his remark that the method is a good educational tool, he asks, the implication is that halakha is a development. This is a challenge to Torah Bal Peh Min HaShamayim. Is it confusing for the student? Okay, well, Tuvia, I'd like to explain, and Neil and Marsha, and I'd like to you to participate in a discussion. The implication that halakha is a development is not a challenge to Torah Shebal Peh Min HaShamayim, because even one who holds a maximum opinion about the giving of Torah Shebal Peh Min HaShamayim at Har Sinai, for instance, which is our traditional position in the halakhic world, and I share that position, of course, that has nothing to do with the fact that since Har Sinai, halakha is a process of development, because the Torah itself said in Parashat Shoftim that when something is not clear to us, that we go to the Shoftim that will be in those days, and they will tell us the Devar HaMishpat. And the Mefarshim on that Pasuk indicate that the Devar HaMishpat that the Shoftim will give us is either relating to us the Masorah that existed until their day, or their Psika on issues that have not been resolved up until their day. So the concept of development as an ongoing phenomenon in Halakha is something that is so obvious in the system of Torah Shebal Peh that it almost doesn't require explication. There is no one anywhere in the system, in the halakhic system, that held that all parts of Torah Shebal Peh that we know today were given at Sinai. It was always understood that a certain percentage was given at Sinai, the initial percentage, the initial halakhot, and the rules for the development of halakha, the midot, shatara, nidreshet, etc., and that from that point on, the chachamim continued to develop the halakha in accordance with the regulations given at Sinai. That is the traditional Orthodox opinion for what halakha is, and therefore, the fact that in some yeshivot, the concept that halakha is not developmental, that's just simply an error, and it causes some serious hashkafic problems on the part of students, because how can halakha be relevant if it doesn't continue to develop and relate to the developing issues of the different time periods in which we live? So I think what's confusing for the student is the other way around, is assuming that there is no halakhic development. Now what our method tries to do is to demonstrate how this halakhic development was constant and regular throughout the period of the Tanaim and the Amoraim. You can see it in the layers in the Sugya and in the layers in the Mishnah, and certainly you can see it in the relationship of the Stamma de Gemara to the layers of the Amoraim. It is true that from the time we've been propagating this system as an educational tool for the last 7 years, that there have been moments in which there was debate in various rabbinical circles about our approach. But in the present time, we now are having quite a fortunate period here in Israel where we are collecting letters of haskama from leading rabbanim and Rosh Yeshiva in order to demonstrate that we are not at all saying anything that is outside the norm in the Masorah. We're just emphasizing certain elements of the Masorah a little more as a didactic instrument for those who are beginning their study in Gemara and for students in yeshivas. Are there any other initial questions before we go into our next sugya? I suggested that because many people might have thought that we were on vacation this week, that maybe we use this time for questions about our method. So if any of you out there have questions about the method we're using, this would be a time to ask them. Otherwise, we will proceed with the next sugya on the pages that you've received, which is sugya number 4. Are there any other questions before we proceed? Okay, I would ask all of you please to take a lesson from Jeff Cooperman at Cherry Hill and get yourselves a camera and earphones and a mic so that you can all participate and I can see who you are, as you can see me and him. Okay, let us, are there any questions one last time before we proceed?
Yeah, I actually have a question. You often talk about the different generations.
Jeff, do you have a question?
How solid is that, all that research about like the Lucy's Helmet and, you know, where they all fall out and that, on the big list?
I'm sorry, I don't hear any questions or see any, so I'm going to proceed. If we take a look at Sugya number 4, it's based on a new Mishnah. The Mishnah says, Ha'omer le'isha, Hareyat mikudeshet li al menat she'etein lach matayim zuz. A man says to a woman, you are mikudeshet to me on the condition that I give you 200 zuz. Now, of course, this is separate from the Kesef Kiddushin itself. The Kesef Kiddushin, as brought down at the very beginning of the Masechet, is a Shaveh Pruta, according to Beit Hillel, and a Dinar, according to Beit Shammai, which is 24 Prutot. And the 200 zuz that we're talking about here is an additional conditional element that the Mekadesh is tacking on to his proposal. 200 zuz is a lot of money. We're talking about an equivalent in modern day of about 25,000 Israeli shekels, or a little bit more than 6,000 American dollars, significant sum. So the man says to the woman, you're mekudeshet to me on the condition that I give you 200 zuz. And the Mishnah says, harezu mekudeshet, in such a case, she is considered mekudeshet, vehu yitain, and he will give. Now what does it mean, and he will give? Does that mean if and when he gives, or does it mean that he will give? In other words, she's mekudeshet him already, it's a fait accompli, but that he must give her the amount that he stipulated. It's not clear from the Mishnah, as we're going to see in the sugya itself. Then the Mishnah gives us a second case. Al menat she'etin lach mikan ve'ad shloshim yom. He says, you're mekudeshet to me on the condition that I'm going to give you the money within the next 30 days. Now this is of course different than the first case brought in the Mishnah, because in this case he's delimiting the condition by time, and therefore the Mishnah says, Natan la betoch shloshim mikudeshet ve'im la ve'inam mikudeshet. If he gave her the 200 zuz within the 30 day period that he stipulated, then she's mikudeshet. If he doesn't, she's not mikudeshet. Of course, it's not clear what is her status during the 30 days before he gives her the money. Is she mikudeshet or not mikudeshet? And that will have a lot of implications for her and for him. The Mishnah doesn't tell us. And then the Mishnah says, al menat sheyeshli matayim zuz, harezu mikudeshet v'yeshlo. If he says, you are mikudeshet to me on the condition that I happen to have 200 zuz, he's not planning to give it to her, but he happens to have it, then she is mikudeshet to him if he has 200 zuz at that time. Not that he has it in potential. He has to have it at that time. Almanat she'areich matayim zuz, if he says, you're mikudeshet to me on the condition that I will show you 200 zuz, harezu mikudeshet v'yarela, then she's mikudeshet to him and he will show her 200 zuz. And if he shows her on the table, she's not mikudeshet, because on the table means that he's a shulchani, that is, he's a money changer, and he happens to have the money on the table, but it doesn't belong to him, and therefore it is misleading for her, and she's not mikudeshet. Jeff is asking from Cherry Hill, if we're saying, if he has it, can't we say that the first part, v'hu yitain, means that if he gives? What do you mean by if he gives? Meaning that she's not mikudeshet until he gives, or she's mikudeshet conditionally up until when he gives? What it's not clear what you're saying either. Yes, yes, what? That she will not be mikudeshet until he gives? Is that what you mean? She will not be mikudeshet until he gives? And then, when he gives it, she's mikudeshet. In other words, she's not mikudeshet until he gives it to her. Okay, if that's the implication that you're suggesting, then that would make the first case of the Mishnah consistent from a linguistic point of view, from a syntax point of view as well, with the third case of the Mishnah. Because the idea of v'yeshlo, that he has it at the time that he says, would imply that she's mikudeshet when he gives it to her. Yes, I would agree with that implication. Let's take a look at what the Gemara does with this. The Gemara brings us Memrot of Rav Yehuda and Rav Huna in an Itmar structure. It says It Amar, which means it was said. Rav Huna Amar Vehu Yitain. Rav Yehuda Amar Lichashe Yitain. What does this mean? Rav Huna says that she is Mikudesha to him in any event, but he must give her the money. In other words, she's already Mikudesha now. And whether or not he gives her the money in the next 30 days or the next 100 days doesn't matter. In any event, she is mikudeshet to him, and he must give her the money. It's almost as if it's an obligation or a loan of some sort, an obligation that he must pay her. But the kiddushin are not in question. That's according to Rav Huna. But Rav Yehuda says lichashe yitein, that the kiddushin will not be chal. It will not have any impact until he gives her the money, which is what Jeff was suggesting from Cherry Hill. And so what we end up with here is a machloket of the two Roshei Yeshiva from the second generation of the Amoraim, Rav Huna from Sura and Rav Yehuda from Pumbedita, about what is the meaning of the condition brought in the Mishnah. So it's clear that, and by the way, both Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda were students of Rav, and Rav was a student, or the student really, of Rivi, who edited the Mishnah. So if there's a machloket between Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda about what it was that Rivi intended, that it's clear that from the very earliest stages it wasn't clear what Rivi wanted from this halacha in the Mishnah. Now, in the Gemara sees a need to explain what Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda are saying. And I've explained the statements of Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda to you in accordance with what the Gemara is now going to present. In component number 2 on your sheets, Rav Huna Amar Vehu Yitain Tana'a Have Mikayam Tana'a Ve'Azel. Rav Yehuda Amar Lichshe Yitain Lichi Yahev Havu Kiddushe Hashtamiha Lo Havu Kiddushe. That Rav Huna is saying Vehu Yitain, meaning it's a Tanai, that the kiddushin is binding, but the tanai is that he has to give her the money at some point in the future, and we'll see to what extent that goes. But he has to give her the money. But the kiddushin is chal immediately, whereas Rav Yehuda says that when he gives her the money, there'll be kiddushin. But until then, there are no kiddushin. This is the explanation of the Gemara. That's the way I explained the Maimers to you at the beginning. But let me ask you something. Take a close look at the Maimers themselves. Rav Huna Amar Vehu Yitain, Rav Yehuda Amar Lichashe Yitain. Is it clear from the Maimers themselves without the Gemara that there's an argument between Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda? Without the explanation of the Gemara. Or could it be that Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda are saying the same thing, only in different ways? That when Rav Huna says Vehu Yitain, meaning she'll be mikudeshet when he gives, and Rav Yehuda is saying Lichashe Yitain, that these are just two different, and Rav Yehuda is maybe explaining what Rav Huna meant. Would it be an issue? Well, now, an issue of semantics, Jeff is suggesting. No, not necessarily an issue of semantics. In other words, do we have here a machloket? Do we have a situation where Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda were aware of each other's opinions, and we're consciously cholik one on the other? Because the arrangement of the opinions in the Memra are not the classic form of a machloket. A machloket would have to be Amar Rav Huna Vehu Yitain, Rav Yehuda Amar Licha Sheyitein. That would be the classic format for a machloket. But what we have here is not that classic format. We have two statements. Rav Huna Amar Vehu Yitein and Rav Yehuda Amar Licha Sheyitein. As if they're just two independent statements, but not necessarily in machloket one with the other. And indeed, this is a possible... So Teddy in Brooklyn is saying, could be either way. Yes, could be either way. Could be a machloket, or possibly not a machloket. And that would explain to us why the Stamad Gemara, in its wisdom, felt it had to explain the opinions of Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda, in order to, what we might say in poor English, to disambiguate the situation. Because just from the Maimers themselves, one could have a Havamina that there's no machloket, that they're saying the same thing in two different ways. Comes the Gemara and says, no, they're not saying the same thing in two different ways. They're saying two different things. Rav Huna, it says that the Kiddushin is Chal now, but he has to give her the money afterwards. And Rav Yehuda is saying the Kiddushin is not Chal until he gives her the money. And then the Gemara, based on its interpretation of the two statements of Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda, the Gemara asks, my Benayu, what are the practical implications of these two differing opinions according to our explanation? Ike Benayu Shapashtaya Davi Kibla Kiddushin Meacher. The Rav Huna Lo Havu Kiddushin, the Rav Yehuda Havu Kiddushin. That if at the time when the man gave, he said to her, Harea Mikudeshetli Almanache Tin Lach Matayim Zuz, and then before he gave her the money, the woman accepted Kiddushin from another man, what will be the din? Shall we say that she is Mikudeshet to the second man because since the first man has not filled his Tanai, that the Kiddushin were never effective and therefore she was single and was capable of accepting Kiddushin from a second man? Or shall we say no, the Kiddushin of the first man were Chal, the fact that he didn't fulfill his condition, that's a shame on him and he will fulfill it in the future, but the Kiddushin are there and therefore she cannot accept Kiddushin from another man? This is a practical implication of the explanation of the Gemara that Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda are arguing. And the separation of the Maimra from the Gemara enables us to see this fine point in the discussion that otherwise we may not have noticed. Now, let me ask you, how can we know that we are to separate the Itmar in component number one from component number two and three? How do we know that they're not the same layer in the sukya, but that they represent two different layers, one being Amoraim and one being the Stamad Gemara? How do we know? What are the two signs? Who would like to offer a suggestion? The two signs that they are not of the same layer. Yes, Teddy in Brooklyn says Hebrew, and Jeff joins him, Hebrew versus Aramaic. Notice that the Memra itself, Rav Huna Amar Vehu Yitein and Rav Yehuda Amar Licha Sheyitein, are in perfect Mishnaic Hebrew, even though both Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda lived in Bavel and did not learn in Eretz Israel. Their Memra is edited in Hebrew, as opposed to the remainder of the Gemara in components number 2 and 3, which is in pure Babylonian Aramaic. Very good. That is the one first sign that we are to separate the Maimer from the Gemara. What is the second sign? Okay, the second sign is named versus anonymous. That the Maimrot appear with the names of those who say them. Rav Huna says, Rav Yehuda says. But in component number 2 and 3, the explanations of the Gemara are anonymous. These two factors, named versus anonymous, and Hebrew versus Aramaic, are the consistent items that divide between the words of the Amoraim and the commentary of the Gemara. Now note in component number 2 and component number 3 that we have two separate components of the Stamad Gemara that are relating to the Memra in different ways. The first component, component number 2, the first component of the stoma here, is what we call Pirush HaMemra. It's explaining the Memra. It's explaining the Svarot of Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda. But the second part of the stoma of the Gemara, component number three, is not Pirush HaMemra. It's rather dealing with halachic implications. It's drawing the nafkamina between the two shitot on the basis of the Pirush HaMemra done in component number two. So you now, whether or not component number two and component number three are from the same layer of stoma is itself a question. You know that there are layers, historical layers, in the stoma as well. Not all of the stoma de Gemara was written at the same time. There were the earlier layers of the stoma de Gemara come from the very, very early Savoraim. That's why they explain the Svara of the Amoraim. And the Shrichuta, or the Mai Binayu, like we have in three, are generally later. They're later pieces of Stoma de Gemara, maybe later in the period of the Savoraim. And they come to explain the implications of the explanations of the earlier Savoraim. Now, this is the first time in our lessons that I've mentioned that the layers can be distinguished even in the Stoma de Gemara. You're all used to my distinguishing between the Amoraim and the Stoma de Gemara as different layers, and distinguishing layers within the Amoraim based on the names of the Amoraim, their locations and their generations and their Batei Medrash. But this is the first time that I've noted that in the Stoma de Gemara itself, it is possible to detect a layering. Now, this is only natural because the Stoma de Gemara was created over a period of approximately 200 years, which is just as long, almost as long, as the period of the Amoraim itself. Because the Amoraim, of course, were in eight generations, from the year 220, from the death of Rivi, until 500, a period of 275 years. The Stoma de Gemara was created over a period of 200 years following the Amoraim, and that's so it stands to reason that within the Stoma de Gemara there will be clear layers of development. It's hard for us to find them because there are no names, and therefore we have to rely on functions or on relationships of the different pieces of material, what is commenting on what and what is explaining what and what is based on what. But nevertheless, there is apparently a layering effect in the Stoma de Gemara as well. Okay, are there any questions about the first part of our sukya, components 1 through 3? Please push down your transmit button to speak, or type in your questions or comments in the dialog box. No questions or comments? Everything is well in North America. Okay. Now, Jeff Kupruma from Cherry Hill is asking, what are key Srichuta terms? Well, we're going to deal with the Srichuta in component number 8 of this sugya in just a few minutes. Jeff, if you can just hang on a few minutes, we'll get there and we'll deal with it at that time. Let's move on. In component number 4, the Gemara tells us that there is a and that is in Masechet Teddy in Brooklyn is asking, did Rav Huna Rosh Yeshiva in Surah after Shmuel died and the yeshiva was moved from Nehardea to Pobedita in 258. So therefore, they knew each other very well, and they definitely must have spoken to each other, but that has nothing to do with the question of whether or not this Memra is a machloket or not, because the whether it's a machlokin or not is dependent on how the statements of Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda were edited into their present form, and not whether or not they actually spoke to each other in this instance. So in any event, the Gemara is telling us that Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda had a similar argument about Gittin, and it's presented in component number 5. Eat Amar, Rav Huna Amar Vuhi Titain, Rav Yehuda Amar Lichashet Titain. Exactly the same case. A man says to a woman, you are divorced from me on the condition that I give you 200 zuz, or that you will give me, 200 zuz. The man is prepared to give the woman a get by extorting from her 200 zuz. And the Mishnah itself says, Harezu migureshet v'hi titain. She's divorced, and she'll give him the money. So on this, Rav Huna said, v'hi titain, meaning the divorce is effective now. But she has to give him the money. It's a condition on her. At some point, the money has to transfer, but she's divorced immediately. But Rav Yehuda says, lichashet titain, that she won't be divorced until she gives him the money. Without money, no get. And we can see that Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda are not only arguing with the same principles, it's exactly the same Mimra. Compare component number 5 to component number 1. It's exactly the same, word for word. And this, of course, raises a very important question. Did Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda say this twice? Or did they only say it once, and it was then transferred by a later editor to a second place? Because, as we know, there's a very inherent connection between Kiddushin and Gittin, V'yatzah V'haytah. We have a Hikesh of Kiddushin and Gerushin, and therefore many dinim that are appropriate to one are appropriate for the other. And when we have a machloket Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda that appears in the Gemara in two places, that doesn't mean necessarily that it was said twice. This could be what we call a transfer sugya. That is, that it was written once, and in the border of the manuscript, a Rishon, or maybe even a Gaon, wrote, Ayen, take a look at this other place where it would be relevant. And then the next Sofer may have simply copied the sugya from one place to the other, and therefore we end up with the sugya appearing in two places. But Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda mentioned it in one place because they assumed that it would be understood that it applies in both places. This is a very common event in the development of the Gemara as we have it. Approximately a quarter, that is 25% of the entire Babylonian Gemara that we have today, is the result of the transferring of sugyas from one place to the other. That's why if you look in Masorat HaShas on the side of the page, you'll see that there are sugyas that appear not only twice, there's sugyas that appear 3 times, 4 times, even 6 times all over Shas. And that's not because the Amoraim sat down time after time and said, oh, you know, we really enjoyed saying it once, let's say it again, again, and again, and again. But they said it once, and then the readers and the copyists transferred their opinions from one place to the next, or from one sugya from one place to the next, where it had some relevance. Jeff Kupperman is from Cherry Hill is asking, could it be that when the Mamre was taught, it was not clear which halacha it was applied to? That's a very interesting suggestion, Jeff. It could be that they said it in a general shiur about Kiddushin and Gerushin, saying that in everything having to do with Ishut, that a Tanai will be operated like this, or a Tanai will be operated like that. And then their opinions were stated again by their students, both in the context of Kiddushin and in the context of Gerushin, which gave them the impression that they said the halakha twice. Now, why am I belaboring this point? Because in component number 6 and 7, the Gemara will again go over the same two steps that it did in components 2 and 3. It says, Rav Huna amar vihi titein tna'a have mekaima tna'a ve'azla. Rav Yehuda amar lichashet titein v'chi havi alei hu dehavi get hashtami alo havi get. exactly similar to the to component number two. And component number seven is exactly like component number three. My binayu, ika binayu, shenit kara get o sheavad. If in between the time the get was given and the money was given by her to him, the get either went lost or it was torn. Is it a get or is it not a get? Ravuna would say it is a get because it was effective from the time it was given without the giving of the money. And Rav Yehuda would say that it's not effective because the money wasn't given yet. So Jeff is asking, according to my explanation, was number seven a Gaonic addition? Well, why do you ask, Jeff, only about number seven? You should ask also about number six, yes? As a matter of fact, you could ask about five through seven as well. Yes, that's right. And so, and it could be. I mean, we have no way of proving it because we don't have manuscripts from the time of the year 600, 700 in order to determine whether this sugya was in both Kiddushin and in Gittin. We don't know. We have no way of determining that, but we can surmise that it could, that it might have been a Gaonic addition. That, and you're saying, therefore, is it post-Savoraim? Well, Gaonim are after the Savoraim. And we know that there are many places in Shas, 200 that I've been able to find so far, where Rishonim actually say about certain lines in the Gemara that they come from the period of the Gaonim. So it is possible. It wouldn't be disturbing, because we know it's a common occurrence. But there's no way to prove it in this case. We don't. In this case, for instance, there are no Rishonim here on this sugya that say that the Gaonim added this in. Jeff, when you say 200, what do you mean 200? Yeah, 200. There are 200 places where the Rishonim say about certain pieces of Gemara that they came from the Gaonim. And if you want that list, just send me an email, and I will email the list back to you for your reference. Now, after the Gemara finishes describing this sugya of Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda in Kiddushin, and that the similar argument is also presented in Gittin, then in component number 8, the Gemara learns a Tzrichuta, and this is was asked about previously, about the language of Tzrichuta. And the Tzrichuta begins with component number 8, and it says as follows, Utzricha, that we actually need both arguments. Di'i ashma'inan gabi Kiddushin, because if the Gemara would have taught me the machloket of Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda by Kiddushin, Vehaka amar Rav Huna, mishum dile karova ka'ate, aval gerushin dile rachaka ka'ate, ema modele le Rav Yehuda. Because in the case of Kiddushin, what is the man trying to do? He's trying to bring the woman closer to him. He wants to be makadish her. He wants to marry her. And therefore, we would assume that the man wants the Kiddushin to be chal immediately, and whether he's going to give her the money now or later does not affect his desire to marry her. So we would say that in that kind of a case, Rav Huna is stipulating that the Kiddushin would be effective immediately. But in the case of Gerushin, where he's coming to push her away, we might say that he's going to agree with Rav Yehuda and only let her have the get when she gives him the money. And on the other hand, if it, the machloket would have been said by Gerushin and not by Kiddushin, that it's dafka by Gerushin that Rav Huna would say that it's effective immediately without her giving the money, because he has no qualms whatsoever about suing her for the money if she delays in giving it to him. Aval hacha, but in the case of Kiddushin, but in a case of marriage where the woman is not going to feel very comfortable to sue her husband for the money that she promised him as part of the Kiddushin, we might say we're not going to let the Kiddushin be chal until he gives her the money. And therefore we might say that Rav Huna would agree to Rav Yehuda in the case of Kiddushin. And therefore, says the Gemara in conclusion, Tzricha, and therefore we needed both the case of Kiddushin and the case of Gittin in order to demonstrate that Rav Huna's argument with Rav Yehuda is consistent in both cases. Now, this Tzrichuta, of course, is a patterned argumentation. By patterned argumentation, we mean that there's a fixed format of the Tzrichuta. Tzrichuta occurs in Shas hundreds of times, close to 1,000 times, actually, in slightly different variations. It's a very common formulation. And you can actually separate in the Tzrichuta between the words that belong to the formula and the words that belong to the case. Let's take a look at that. The words that belong to the formula are, beginning at the very beginning of component number 8, Tzricha, De'i ashma'inan ex, Ve'ha ka'amar ploni, Mishum de, and a reason is given. Aval in Y, De, why it's different, Ema, the opposite. That's the formula. And then the other side of the formula, Ve'i itmar on Y, Ve'hach kamar ploni, Mishum de, and his reason. Aval the X, but in the case X, De, the reason, Ema, I would say, he agrees to Almoni, Tzricha. And this format of the Tzrichuta is consistent in hundreds of places in Shas, which of course tells us that the way to teach this from a didactic point of view is to teach the child the formula and give him 10 cases where it occurs and have him find the formula in the various cases so that he's not going to have to figure it out every time he sees it, but he'll know automatically how to read the lines of the Gemara fluently because he knows the structure. This is true of many, many structures in the Stam of the Gemara. The Stam of the Gemara uses approximately 50 fixed structures in its argumentation. My staff is busy right now compiling all of these to publish a book on all of the structures of the Stam of the Gemara for use in the schools as an exercise book. And so this is one of the characteristics of Stam of the Gemara as opposed to Amoraim. Amoraim do not use these kinds of structures. You'll only find them in the Stam of the Gemara. And the reason for that is because the Stam of the Gemara is concerned with teaching Svara, teaching the logic, and therefore it developed language and argumentation structures that would be appropriate for teaching the logic of the arguments of the Amoraim. Does that answer the question from before about the structure of the Tzrichuta? It would be a good idea for you to take a marker and to mark the elements of the Tzrichuta that are the general formula. Again, they are Utzricha, De'i Ashma'inan, De'ha, Mishum De, Aval, De, Ema, and I Itmar, De'ha, Mishum De, Aval, Hacha, De, Ema, Lo. Okay? That's the format of the Tzrichuta. Now, what I want to point out at this stage is that we've gone through several stages in understanding the development of this sugya. The sugya starts with a statement of Tu Amoraim, Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda, and we asked whether or not Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda are arguing definitely, or whether they're saying the same idea in two different ways. And we saw that on the level of the Amoraim itself, it isn't clear. That's why the Gemara comes and clarifies for us that they are arguing. That was step one of the Stam of the Gemara. Step two of the Stam of the Gemara was to tell us the implications of the argument with Amai Benayu. Then the third step of the Stam of the Gemara is to say, well, now that we have a clear understanding that there is a machloket, and that this machloket has clear implications, we note that the Gemara brings the machloket twice, and therefore there must be a reason why it's brought twice. Not that it's brought twice because the copyists transferred it here from somewhere else, and that it really is just repeated. It's repeated for a reason. It's repeated to tell me that you might have thought that Rav Huna would agree with Rav Yehuda by Kiddushin, or you might have held that he might agree with Rav Yehuda by Gerushin in Masechet Gittin. And therefore, the Gemara had to bring you the Machloket, Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda, in both places in order that you would not make that mistake, and you would understand that the disagreement between them is consistent in both cases. Please note, however, that even if we, after saying the Tzrichuta, that Tzrichuta is not saying to us, this is therefore evidence that the Machloket was said twice, but rather, why the Machloket, which was said once, is brought in two places. Okay, so our question about whether it was actually said twice or only said once and recorded in two places, our question is still unresolved. The Gemara does not relate to it, and you can quote about another 50 places in at least in Shas where you have this phenomenon of something appearing more than once, and the Gemara learning at Srihuta why it appears more than once, and that does not necessarily reflect on whether it was said more than once or it was only said once and transferred to several places. All right, let's move on. Are there any further questions on this so far, on this sugya, or on the method that we're using? Please feel free. No questions? Not in writing? Not by sound? Okay. So Teddy, you're saying, so there is no way the, finish your question, please, Teddy. So there's no way that what, Teddy? There is no way that the Tzrichuta was transferred. Well, that's a very good question. Because if you look in Gittin, from the place from where the from which the sugya is quoted here, you'll see that in Gittin the whole sugya is presented in opposite order. First, the machloked on Gittin with its rationale, and then the Gemara will say we have the same machloked in Kiddushin, and it brings it, and then it learns its Srihuta the other way around. So the Srihuta, you could say, was also transferred, but it was, as it was transferred, it was adapted for the location in which it was to be found, whether in Gittin or in Kiddushin. Any other questions before we move on? Okay, let's go on. In component number 9, the Gemara asks a question. Meitivei. Now, as you know, all of the questioning words in the Gemara have specific functions. There are three ways to bring a braita in the Gemara. Three families of words that bring braitas in the Gemara. The first is the words that are based on the shoresh taf nun aleph, like tanu rabbanan, tanya, tana, tanina. Those words all bring a braita for purposes of discussion. If you add the question hey at the beginning, vehatnan, or vehatanya, or vehatanena, then you get a question. The second family of words that bring braitot are based on the shoresh resh mem yud, raminhu, rame, which means to cast the braita against another source of the Tanaim, whether a Mishnah or another Braita. What we have here, Meitivei, belongs to the third family of introductory words of the Braita, which all come from the Shoresh, Taf Yud Bet. So David Sal is asking from New York City, Tana Rabbanan is always a Braita. Yes, it's always a Braita. Sometimes Tana Rabbanan means the Braita is being quoted from the Tosefta, but it's always a Braita, meaning it's never a Mishnah, that's for sure. Because a Mishnah is always brought with the introductory word Tanan, or Tanina Chadaz, or Tanina, but never Tana Ravana. So Meitivei comes from the family of words that start has the Shoresh Taf Yud Bet, like Eitivei, Meitivei, Motiv, Mativ, and Otiv, and these all refer to the quoting of a Baraita as a question against an Amora. That is, you're quoting a stronger source against a weaker source. And David Saul is asking, a Brita is from an earlier source? What do you mean, earlier than what? A Brita is the bringing of a source from the Tanaim that is from the same period as the Mishnah, but is outside the Mishnah. So the word Brita means something that is outside, something that is outside the Mishnah. And it could be a Tosefta, it could be a Medrash Halacha, it could be a Brita from the compilation of Bar Kappara, or from Levi, or from Rav Huna, or any of the others who compiled collections of the words of the Tanaim. But it always means something from the Tanaim. Either something from the Tanaim against something else from the Tanaim, in the case of Rami Raminu, or in our case, Meitive, something from the Tanaim against something from the Amoraim. And let's see what the question is. Meitive, Harete Gitecha Menachit Ili Matayim Zuz. This is your get on the condition that you give me Matayim Zuz. And David Saul says, who said what is inside or outside? Yeah, that's a very, very good question. In other words, why do we call things outside the Mishnah as Braitot? Why don't we call the Braitot a Mishnah and call the Mishnah a Braita? And the reason why I say your question is so well taken, David, is because in the Yerushalmi, you'll often see that Rabbi Yochanan bases his sugyas on the Tosefta, and he brings the Mishnah of Rebbe as a Braita. Braita simply means outside of the source that is considered to be authoritative and the basis of discussion. And in the Bavli, the source that is considered the basis of discussion is the Mishnah, and therefore all Tanaitic sources outside the Mishnah are considered Braitot. In Eretz Yisrael, in Tveria, I might not have been that way at all. But you're right, these are relative terms, and they are based on what is the accepted format for study in any given place. So the Braita that's being quoted here tells us that if a man says to a woman, this is your get on the condition that you give me Matayim Zuz, then even though the get will be torn or lost, she's still Megureshet. But even though she is Megureshet, we ask her not to marry anyone else, Le'acher lo tinaseh ad shetiten, that is better she not marry someone else until she gives the money. But she's considered Megureshet even though she hasn't given the money yet. This is a kasha, this is an argument on whom? On which Amora? Which Amora is being attacked by this Braita? This is an Amora eating Braita. And who is it eating? Who is it that said that the get will not be effective until she gives the money? Rav Yehuda. That's right, Neil. Rav Yehuda. And therefore, this is a kasha on Rav Yehuda. And then, yes, Rav Yehuda, that's right, Jeff. So, Otanya, and furthermore, we have another Braita, Amar la harezek itecha menachit nili matayim zuz vemeit. If a man says to a woman, this is your get on the condition that you'll give me 200 zuz, and then he dies. Well, David Saul says actually both. Good, but not exactly. Let's wait a few more lines, David, and you'll see that it's not exactly as you suggest. That if she gave the money to him before he died, ein zkuka liyavam, that she doesn't have to have levirate marital relations with his brother. Lo nitna, but if she didn't give, zkuka liyavam, then she does. Rav Anshim Gamliel omer, no tenet leachiv, o leaviv, o leachad min akruvim, that even if she didn't give him the money before he died, she may give it to one of the heirs of the man who died, to her former husband. Now the Gemara then comments on this, Ad kan lo pligi ela de mor savar liva lo li yorshai u mor savar afilu li yorshai. De kuli alma miha tanahave, that here the internal argument between these two braitot is only whether or not the money once promised must it be given to the one to whom it was promised, or can it be given also to one of their heirs? But everyone holds that it's a Tanai, and that the action of Kiddushin or Gerushin will be effective even before the Tanai is fulfilled. And therefore, in 9D, 9 Dalid, the Gemara concludes, Tiyuvta de Rav Yehuda. This is a refutation of Rav Yehuda. Notice, David Saul from New York, the Gemara doesn't say refutation of Rav Yehuda and Rav Huna. It's a refutation of Rav Yehuda. because both of the sources imply that the action, whether it be gittin or kiddushin, will be effective even before the money is transferred. And in 9:1, the Gemara then supplies an answer for Rav Yehuda. Amar lach Rav Yehuda. Rav Yehuda would say to you, this is not Rav Yehuda speaking, this is not a Mimra. This is the Stam of the Gemara speaking in Rav Yehuda's name. That's why it says Amar lach, and not Amar le, or Amar. It says Amar lach Rav Yehuda. Rav Yehuda would say to you, ha manhi, who are these brightot going according to? Ribihi, they go according to Rebbe. De Amar Rav Huna Amar Ribi, Kol HaOmer Amanat Ki Omer Me'achshav Dami, Upligi Rabbanan Alei, Ve'anad Amarit Ki Rabbanan. That these statements are the statements of Rebbe, as brought down by Rav Huna, that Rav Huna explains that Rebbe holds that anyone who uses the language of Almanat is saying Me'achshav, that it's relevant from now, of the time that he's saying it, and therefore, these Piskei Din in Gittin and Kiddushin are from the time that they're said, and even if the money is not transferred. But says the Gemara in the name of Rav Yehuda, or for Rav Yehuda, better, that the rabbis, the Chachamim, argued against Rebbe, and his position goes according to the Chachamim. Now, what exactly is going on here? The Gemara, from its extensive knowledge of Braitot, brings two Braitot that seem to imply that Rav Yehuda is mistaken in his understanding of the Mishnah. Now this itself, as a suggestion, is utterly unacceptable. The Gemara does not want to come to the conclusion that in a machloket between two Amoraim, that one Amora is in error. It wants to preserve both opinions of the Amoraim as being equally consistent and equally acceptable. I call this the law of preservation of Memrot. And therefore, the Stam of the Gemara, what it will do is it will provide a svara or a source for the Amora that was attacked in order to buttress his opinion and make it possible for him to survive. Now, in this case, because the attack on Rav Yehuda came from a Braita, the only solution, the only thing that can save Rav Yehuda is to claim that there is an alternative opinion of the Tanaim, which is cholek on these braitot, that would agree to him. And so David is saying, so Rebbe, in creating halacha, made a stam statement as a yachid. That is correct. Yes, he did. This is how he paskened. But that the Chachamim, who disagreed with Rebbe, are the basis of Rav Yehuda's psak. Now, David Saul is raising a very good question. He's saying, how can Rebbe put in as a stam mishnah a statement which of his own as a yachid, when the majority disagree with him? How can he do that? Would anyone like to make a suggestion to answer Mr. Saul? Would anyone like to suggest something? Come. Who would like to make a suggestion? I don't hear any of you. Okay, well, first of all, there are several possible explanations of this. Number one, Rebbe was the Nasi. And there are other places that we have among the Tanaim where the Nasi rules, even against the Rov. There were tensions between the Chachamim in some generations and the Nasi on this basis. This is number one. Number two, do you notice that the Gemara does not bring a source where the Chachamim hold against Rebbe? It makes an assertion that there is such a Shita of the Chachamim against Rebbe, and that what we have here is the Shitat Rebbe. but we don't have a source for it yet. So this is an assertion of the Gemara that has to be proven. We need another source that actually shows the Shita of the Chachamim. Where did the Gemara get this from? And that's why this sugya is not really over. It's only this is only a pause. The sugya is going to go on, and it's going to have to analyze this, because the Gemara knows very well it cannot assert that a braita which is brought stam as halacha is brought al dat yachid. It has to prove that it's brought al dat yachid. So David says we do find many times like Moed Katan Amud Beit and Shvit Bizman Azeh Durabanan. Okay, yes, there are other examples of it. That's true. So, but in the Gemara's claim that something like this is going to be a Yachid and not a Rabbin, that has to be demonstrated from a source that there was a Machloket, so that we can compare it to our sources here and see that Rebbe indeed paskened as a Yachid. Okay, this brings us to the end of sugya number 4. It also brings us to the end of our first semester. I was informed by Rabbi Kelman that we're taking a break. My assumption is, he didn't tell me how long, but my assumption is the break is for 2 weeks, that we will not be meeting next week or the week after, unless we're notified differently by Rabbi Kelman. So if that's the case, then Rabbi Kelman wanted you to know the break will be till the end of January or beginning of February. Oh, look at that. I didn't know that. Okay. So at that time, at the end of January or the beginning of February, I will be in the United States, and I will be transmitting from various locations as I did at the beginning of our first semester. So then we have approximately a month off when we won't be learning with each other. But in any event, even though we won't be learning formally on Sundays like this, any of you are invited at any time to send me your questions or your comments or your requests for material to my email, which I'm going to be typing here on the screen, so that you can contact me anytime you wish. Please note it down and feel free to contact me at any time. Okay? So, wishing you all well. You should have a safe and healthy winter. You can also send feedback or suggestions to info, and be very well, all of you. As we say in Hebrew, Choref Bari, have a healthy winter, and we'll see you again in about a month's time. All the very best, and signing off from Elkanah in the Jewish Shomron. Bye-bye.